The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Welcome to the Career Contessa podcast, your shortcut to being more fulfilled, healthy, and successful at work. I'm your host, Lauren McGoodwin, and I'm so excited to share today's conversation with Sunil Gupta. He's the founding CEO of Rise, a visiting scholar at Harvard Medical School, and the author of Everyday Dharma, 8 Essential Practices for Finding Success and Joy in Everything You Do. Sunil and I had a fantastic conversation, and we discuss everything from the arrival fallacy, why you achieve more with only 85% effort, tips for resetting your energy in just 5 minutes, and how to create better alignment in your own life. You guys are going to love this episode. Can't wait for you to hear it. And please remember to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of our show. One review equals 1,000 new downloads, and it's the number one way to help new people find our show, which is exactly what we love to have happen. All right. And now this is the Career Contessa podcast. Hi, Sunil. Welcome to the show.
Lauren, such a big fan of the show. Good to be here.
Let's start by having you briefly introduce who you are, your work, and your most recent book, Everyday Dharma.
Sure. So my name is Sunil Gupta. I am an author and an entrepreneur. I travel around the world and study great leaders, but I try to take a little bit of a different approach, which is I'm not that interested in how they behave when everybody is watching. I'm kind of interested in behaving like how they behave behind the scenes. So in other words, what are we doing internally in order to succeed externally? What are the habits that we are practicing behind the scenes that allow us to rise to the top of their game? And I take these habits and I unpack them and I write about them, I speak about them, and I put a lot of them in my latest book, Everyday Dharma.
Amazing. This is like my dream job that you have, is just studying successful people. I guess in a way it's sort of what I do also, just in a little bit different context. But I always say I have the best job because I'm trying to help people be more fulfilled at work by talking to people who are fulfilled at work, right? And sharing those like hacks, secrets, whatever habits they're doing, which usually is not much of a secret. It's more just like a consistency and a discipline, I find, at least.
And I love the format that you do it in, Lauren, because like you have a way of making your guests really comfortable, you know, and I think when you have conversations like that, you can get below the script, right? And when you can get below the script, that's when you get to the real stuff, like the vulnerability of it all, right? And, you know, for me, the way it happened is that I had actually started 2 companies that both failed. And fast forward to a full-length article on failure in the New York Times. My face is the cover of this article. And somebody who was really important to me, she kind of convinced me that what I should do is do something with that article. Instead of like, you know, hiding my head beneath the sand, I should send it out to all these people that I admired as almost like kind of like an entry point for a conversation. And so I did. I started to send this article out to Oscar-winning filmmakers, celebrity chefs, coaches of professional sports teams, leaders of large iconic companies, all these people I admired who had no idea who I was. And all of a sudden, I realized like they were responding. The response rate to that note was way higher than I would have expected. And it opened the door to all these conversations. But the twist was that it wasn't just like the typical, hey, how do you succeed conversation? It was, what do you do when you lose? What do you do when you make mistakes? How do you get over a setback? And I realized that a lot of the stories that I was learning through those conversations, and maybe you're finding this to be the same, were conversations that I wasn't reading online. Yeah. Like if I went to their bio, I went to their profile, I wasn't able to learn these things that had happened to them behind the scenes. And so that's where I think the good stuff lies. I mean, I do think what they say is true. Success is a lousy teacher. And it's the setbacks that teach us the most.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very curious, and maybe I should know this, but what does Dharma mean? And you have a story of losing it, finding it. First, tell us what Dharma means.
Yeah. So, you know, Dharma is your inner calling. And my grandfather, who first introduced me to Dharma, described it to me as your essence. We all have an essence. You have one, I have one. And the question is, how do we express that essence to the world? The challenge is sometimes we confuse essence with occupation. So we think that sometimes essence means I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I work at a company as a marketing specialist. That is an expression of your essence, but your essence is one layer deeper than that. I love to design things. I love to make things. I love to inspire other people. I love to help other people grow. Those are examples of an essence. And the challenge is that when we're in the world of work, we get pulled away from our essence and into this world of occupation, right? And when that happens, which I think it happens to most of us, we start to lose a sense of who we are. So Dharma is not what you do, it is who you are and how who you are gets expressed through what you do. And the way that I like to think about it more than anything else is alignment, right? That there is who you are and there's what you do. And it's really a question of how do we start to align those things? That might actually sound like a gargantuan task, right? Like you have so much stuff going on in your life right now, all the stuff happening with work, but not to mention, you know, potentially kids, drop-offs, pickups, aging parents, all the other things we have going on. None of that stuff goes away just because we get busy in life. So adding sort of this task of alignment can almost seem like one more thing to do. But the good news is that it's just these little adjustments sometimes, these little things. And when we can make even just these tiny little adjustments, all of a sudden we can start to breathe a little bit easier. We can start to feel a little bit more like ourselves. And, you know, as a result, we start to do some of our best work as well.
Interesting. How did you lose your dharma and then find it again? What's that story?
Yeah. You know, for me, I was an entrepreneur. I had moved to Silicon Valley because that's what all the cool
kids. That's what you do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I finished up law school in 2008. The iPhone had just launched. You know, it was a renaissance happening in tech. And most of the people I knew and respected were doing everything they could to move to the Bay Area and become entrepreneurs. And I sort of followed the crowd. And I did not have much luck to start out with. I had been part of one company that imploded. I started two that went nowhere. And finally, I took another shot and, you know, this company worked and it was a grind. I loved what I was building, but I didn't necessarily love being a CEO. It wasn't my calling, you know, but what I kept telling myself, and I think a lot of us tell ourselves this, is like, we are going to get to this point where we're going to reach a level of success. And once we reach that level of success, we will finally be happy.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening for me is after many failures, I finally had one success. And at the end of that one success, I kind of realized like, wow, like I was happy, but for a very, very short period of time. We ended up selling the company. You know, I started getting written up in these, you know, newspapers, and it was a nice stroke to my ego. And it was like, you know, and I finally wasn't in debt anymore. I had a little bit of money in the bank, and that's very freeing. Like there's, yeah. I don't want to minimize that in any way. But the challenge was that literally a couple of weeks later, I woke up with that same sort of empty sort of feeling, that same sort of like, you know, am I doing enough with my life? What do I do now? Sort of feeling that I had before. And I didn't know how to describe that feeling at the time. And it wasn't until years later, when I was in the field as a researcher, I shifted my career after that. And I joined the faculty at Harvard Medical School. And I started to study, you know, all these leaders, that I ran across a theory called the arrival fallacy. And the arrival fallacy, it was coined by Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar. And what it basically means is that we are conditioned to believe that we are going to reach this moment of arrival in our careers, in our lives, where we have accumulated enough wealth, enough status, enough success, that we're going to finally feel that joy that we've been chasing, right? And it's going to last. It's going to feel permanent. And the problem is that for most of us, that never really happens, at least not in the way that we thought it was going to, because every time we hit a milestone, the goalpost moves again. And so you get the deal that you thought was going to end up making you happy. And it's like, what's the next deal?
Right.
You ran the podcast, you know, episode that you've been chasing. And then it's like, it feels really good. But then you're like, who's the next guest?
Yeah.
And it's a cycle that just never stops. The way that dharma sort of looks at this problem, by the way, this is a perennial problem. Like this is something that you know, we see humans writing and discussing for thousands of years. Dharma right. is a millennia old philosophy. And it's really about this idea of the difference between inner success and outer success. So if outer success is wealth, status, success, achievement, then inner success is about joy, fulfillment, a sense of maybe purpose, right? And the belief, I think, that we get conditioned to is that this idea of outer success is going to lead us to inner success.
Yep.
Right. We're going to accumulate enough outer success that we're going to feel inner success. And eventually, I think we all get to the point where we realize it doesn't work that way. And it can feel, by the way, really disconcerting when we get there, right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, what has this all been for? What has been the point of taking out the loans, doing all the work, you know, doing as much as we could to get the job that we destined to get and getting it and then working our asses off? What has it all been for?
Yeah.
And the answer is that while outer success doesn't necessarily lead us to inner success, we can reverse the flow, meaning we can start with inner success. We can have a better sense of what it is that makes us happy, what it is that brings us joy, and we can let that overflow into outer success, right? And when I'm out there and I'm studying all these leaders across all these different worlds, what I realize is that more often than not, they made that switch. They stopped focusing on outer success. They started focusing on inner success. And as a result of that, sometimes unintended, is that they ended up achieving even higher levels of outer success.
Interesting. Okay, so I'm going to ask the question that's on everyone's mind listening to this. How did they make that switch? How do you do that?
Yeah, so I think part of it is that, like, you know, in the question that always comes up is, what is my dharma? How do I find this essence inside of me? And I think the good news is that it's less of a journey of going out into the world and trying to find it. And I think it's more about excavating what's already there, right? Like, I look at dharma very much like Michelangelo would think about a sculpture. He said, you know, he would look at a block of marble and he would say the sculpture is already inside. I just need to chip away the layers that are hiding it. And the same thing is true for your dharma. It is something that is already inside of you. And chances are, at some point in time in your life, you were expressing that essence.
Yeah.
And it may have been when you were a kid. You know, oftentimes when you see therapists do work with, you know, particularly coaching with their clients, they're often talking about, like, what excited you as a kid, right? And there's a reason that they go back there. But it could also be something that's showing up in your day-to-day as well. It just might be tiny and fleeting. And so one of the things that we can do is we can start to chisel away those layers. So in chapter one of the book, I talk about what some of these potential chisels can be. You know, one of my favorite chisels is really, you know, to ask yourself the question, what would you do even if you failed, right? And it's a little bit of a twist on a question you may have heard before, which is, what would you do if you couldn't fail, right? Mm-hmm. If it were impossible to fail, what would you do? And that's a helpful question as well. The tricky thing about that question sometimes, though, is that you might actually put yourself in a position where the journey is not very exciting, but what you're really excited about is a destination, right?
Right.
So you might say, I want to start a hedge fund and make billions of dollars, but you actually don't want to be a hedge fund manager, right? And so that might be a potential answer to what you would do if you couldn't fail, But if you try to answer the question, what would you do even if you did fail? Then all of a sudden that flips it and you start to realize that, like, wow, there are some things out there that, like, I enjoy so much that I would do it even if there wasn't sort of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, right? Because I would truly enjoy the journey. So for me, for example, one of the things I realized is that, like, I loved telling stories. And when I was, you know, working as an entrepreneur, even, I would look forward to the moments that I could get up in front of a potential partner or even an investor and certainly my team, and I could tell them a story about a patient that we were working with. I started a healthcare company and we did one-on-one nutrition coaching to people who focused on lowering the risk for diabetes and hypertension. We would help them get to better health. And when I could tell their stories, I could feel myself come alive.
Yeah.
And literally, if you did not pay me a dime, I would sit there day in and day out and do that, right? Which is why I started to spend time before and after work writing down these stories, which ultimately is what led me to becoming an author. But if you can answer that question, that can be one chisel, right? And there are others as well, but I think that that's a really good one to start with.
It's interesting. It's like, what would you do if you didn't need to make money, right? Like, we've heard variations of this question. One thing I like to ask people too is, like, what's something that gives you energy? You know, a lot of times people are like, I hate my job. What should I do next? And it's like, well, for me, I'll ask people, I'm like, what's the thing that gives you energy? What part of your day are you not miserable? There's usually a part of it. So it's interesting that we're saying different things, but, like, kind of similar messaging. I am very curious too. You essentially talk to successful people who have been able to make this switch about these daily habits or practices that they do. I believe you said there's 8 of them. Can you share what they are? I know we can't go deeply into each of them. Everyone will have to buy your book, but maybe you can just share, like, what are some of these habits? What do they look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I just want to hit, like, that point you just made about what gives you energy is such an important one. And one of the other chisels that we talk about in the book is what I call the bright spots chisel, right? What are these tiny moments in your day, even if you have a miserable sort of work existence right now, what are the tiny, even fleeting moments in your day that are actually bringing you some joy? And it may sound a little bit cliche, but those moments really, really matter. And we have sort of a neurological tendency to dismiss those moments.
Yeah.
Right. Because we do tend to sort of focus on, like, you know, what is wrong. But by just giving a little bit of attention to what is actually going right, what that does is that gives us portals into, I think, some of these joyful sort of tendencies, right? And we can start to unpack them. We can start to figure out, what were we doing? Who was around us? What were the conditions that led to those moments? And when we can start to do that, we can actually start to invite more of that into our life, right? And again, we're talking about alignment here. We're not talking about ripping off a Band-Aid of Dharma. It's like 1% alignments can make a big, big difference. You're asking about some of the habits in the book. And I think the way the book is sort of set up is like, what is it that brings us into our Dharma? But what are also some of the things that take us out of our Dharma, right? On a daily basis. And one of the things that we know takes us out of our Dharma is energy, right? Mm-hmm. Like just not having enough energy in our days. If you're exhausted, it's very, very hard to feel like you're living a purposeful existence. I work a lot with first responders, people who are working inside hospital environments. Like they're full, they got into what they did because they had a lot of meaning behind that intent. But when you get worked to the ground, it's very, very hard to wake up with a sense of purpose. So the point being that like the way that we tend to our own energy really, really matters. In the book, there's this concept of prana that we bring up. And prana is really about this idea of extraordinary energy, right? And how do we bring more extraordinary energy into our lives? One of the ways we see, I think, gifted performers do this is through what I call rhythmic renewal, which is that they're not waiting for vacations or long breaks in order to restore themselves. They're actually turning it into a daily rhythm where they're practicing renewal every single day, multiple times a day throughout the day. In fact, the average high performer that we study is taking somewhere around 8 breaks every single day, 8, wow. Which like, I know sounds extraordinary given the world that we live in, like, cause it's so back to back to back. And if you're like working from home, it's like clicking off of one link, clicking onto another. If you are even back in the office, like yeah. It just seems like things have gotten tighter, way tighter now than they were before. And so one of the ways that we can bring this into our lives is through what I call the 55-5 model, 55-5, which is that for every 55 minutes of work, whenever possible, you're taking 5 minutes of focused, deliberate rest, right? 55 to five. And it's not always possible. Like if you're in a client meeting, you're not going to like get up after 55 minutes. You're like, sorry, time's up. But there are a lot of situations I find, even people who are extremely busy that I coach and work with, there are these pockets throughout the day when they're sitting down for a 60-minute block of work or they're calling a 60-minute meeting. Well, instead, what if you called a 55-minute meeting? What if you sat down for a 55-minute block of work? And then we got as disciplined with the 5 minutes of rest as we are with the 55 minutes of work. And sometimes the pushback that I get is, well, wait a second. I'm trying to find more time in my day, right? And you're telling me to shrink each hour. Like, how is that going to help me? And the answer is that every single one of those 5 minutes has been scientifically proven to make the other 55 minutes far more effective, far more productive, far more creative, bring far more energy, all the qualities that we associate with success. You will have more of that for that 55 minutes. When I put this 55-5 model into practice with the teams that I work with, one of the most common pieces of feedback that I get is that for the first time in my career, I'm feeling as much energy at the end of the day as I did at the beginning of the day, just by taking these 5 minute breaks.
That's huge. Most people are not feeling, at the end of the day, they're so tired, they're wiped, they've got nothing left to give to own personal life, right? So we end up having like, that's that feeling of resentment with your career. It's like getting so much of your energy that your kids don't get any, or your family or your personal or your community or whatever it is.
Showing up as the worst version of yourself. Yeah. I mean, I have 2 kids at home as well. And you know, by the end of the day, like, you know, that's my time with them. And more and more, you know, I have an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old. And I also have 3 nieces who are like borderline college now. And I'm realizing how quickly that time has gone. And so this challenge as a parent of like, I want to invest in my career, but I also don't want to miss the journey with them. And so much of that has to do with not just the time that we're bringing to them, but the energy that we're bringing to them.
Well, this is a good segue into my next question, which is probably also one of the habits of successful people. You say that 85% effort is essentially what you need to give in order to get a great result. Explain that, because most people are killing themselves to get A pluses all the time. Please let us get the B minus.
yeah, sure. This is a controversial one. You know, I spend a lot of time inside of big companies and with leaders who are bring me in to motivate their people. And then I talk about this thing called the 85% rule. And they're like, whoa, wait a second. This isn't what we asked for.
But, yeah.
You know, there was a legendary runner. His name was Carl Lewis, who would somehow defy kind of what people understood about running, because the sort of conventional rule was that in order to be a great sprinter, you kind of had to start at the front of the pack. If you started at the front of the pack, then you were going to finish at the front of the pack. But Carl Lewis had this sort of like, you know, he did the inverse. He would start at the back of the pack and then he would slowly work his way up to the front, and he would do that over and over again. So he kept defying sort of this conventional wisdom. And finally, a coach started to study Carl Lewis. And what he found is that Carl Lewis was basically at 85% effort from the beginning of the race all the way to the end of the race. So whereas some racers were starting out at 100, you know, give 105, 110%, give it everything they got, and then they were kind of tapering down, he was very, very consistent throughout the whole race, right? And what we find amongst top performers, they behave very much the same way. You know, sometimes we feel like in order to get great performances, what we need to do is a squeeze as tight as possible. I had this monk that once described it to me like this. He had a hot cup in his hand, a hot cup of coffee, of tea in his hand. And he if you squeeze the mug really hot, really tight, you're going to burn your hands, right? And eventually you're going to have to set the mug down. But if you can hold the mug lightly, right, then you can hold it for longer,
yeah,
right? And you can hold it more elegantly. And I think sometimes we sort of feel like we have to bring this level of intensity to everything that we do. But when we do that, you know, I think the we bring the grit and the hustle, and we're incessant with that. What we also do is we burn ourselves out. And the reason for that is because if you look at the qualities of grit, you know, always being on, being relentless, working around the clock, these are also some of the same qualities that are scientifically associated with burnout. Right. And I think it puts us in a little bit of a dilemma, right? Where it's like, wow, this was the playbook that I learned on how to succeed. It also happens to be the playbook that leads me directly to burnout. So what do I do now? Like, I don't want to choose between my work and my well-being. I actually want both. I want to do great work. You know, I really do care about my career, but at the same time, I care about my well-being. So how do I have both?
Yeah.
And sometimes the answer is learning how to dial up and dial down your intensity, right? And so what I think about in terms of this 85% rule is not that you always have to be at 85%, but to really sort of think about what the situation calls for. Right. So if you're walking into a meeting with your team, for example, and it's literally a creative brainstorm, and you walk in, your fists are clenched and you're like, you're tight and you're like, that's just not the energy that is needed in that moment. Right. And in fact, most moments don't require that energy. And not only does that bear like not well for you, but it also kind of spreads to everybody else around you. And so counterintuitively, one of the things that I've learned through practice, I've seen other people learn and put into practice themselves, is that lowering the intensity sometimes can be a great way to get better yeah. results.
I've found the exact same thing. And in fact, I actually think one of the best skills that you can develop is learning how to turn the volume up when it needs to be up. Like being able to have enough self-awareness to be like, this is calling for 110% energy. This is really calling for about 60%. You don't need to be the loudest voice in the room. You know, that kind of mentality, especially with the top performers. I'm curious yeah. before I wrap up and ask you a question about failure, since you were literally the face of it. Thanks for taking one for the team. What other habits, like if we could just briefly mention a couple other habits, and obviously, like I said, they have to dive deeper into them in your book, but what would you say are the other top habits you really want to share?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I mean, one that's constantly on my mind right now is a habit called upekkha. And upekkha is all about the comfort in the discomfort, right? So what do we do when we are put in uncomfortable situations? There is, I think, one sort of path, which is to flee, right? Put ourselves in, you know, as few uncomfortable situations as possible. But I think a fully lived life is really with the other path, which is that, like, you know, difficult roads lead to beautiful destinations. And so we need to learn how to put ourselves in the uncomfortable situations and find a way to discover comfort in the discomfort.
Yeah.
Right? And one of the ways that we can do this is through finding some space between impulse and response. And so in the book, I call back to Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, right? A Holocaust survivor, neurologist. And what he said is that, you know, throughout all the difficult times in his life, what he realized is that every time you are triggered, you know, there is a sort of impulse to react as quickly as possible, right? But if you can create some space between that trigger and your response, inside that space lies your freedom. And we can apply that space anywhere, right? It can be with our work. It could be with our colleagues. It can be with our kids, because there's no shortage of triggers in life, right? Yeah. There's no shortage of things that are going to annoy you. And the sort of metaphor, you know, I always find sort of taking Western scientists and sort of relating them back to like a lot of Eastern wisdom. In this case, there's the tale of the prickly porcupine. And Buddha would like to tell this tale of these porcupines that would gather together for warmth, especially in the winter. But because they were gathered so closely together, they would prick each other, right? And so they disbanded and they went out into the cold and they tried to make it alone, and they realized they couldn't, because they needed each other's warmth. So they came back together and they learned how to deal with the pokes. They learned how to deal with the pricks. And that's exactly what I think life is really about, is that we can't abandon each other just because we annoy one another. And we can't abandon our work just because it triggers us. We find ways to live with the discomfort and to manage the discomfort. And that's really what this chapter is all about. Another thing that I struggle with myself, but of course, you know, I put it in the book because it's something that I want to learn myself, is how do we bring a sense of play into our work? And that's a chapter called Leela. And Leela is really about like really blurring the lines between play and work. And what we find is that, you know, in a lot of, across a lot of different worlds, I was finding great leaders say, like, when I can blur that line, when it can feel like work and play are sort of indistinguishable, that is when I do my best work. Like Alex Lowe, for example, mountain climber, he's like the mountain climber who is the best is the one who is having the most fun. Right. And that can sound a little bit like off-putting sometimes, because it's kind of like, wow, like my life is so difficult right now. It's so challenging. Like, how am I supposed to have fun with all of this? But there are some specific sort of tips in the book. And one of the things that I talk about is this idea of high quality habits. And high quality habits are the little habits in life that, not that we think we should do, but that we want to do, right, over and over again. And when we can start to find this intersection of what we want to do, but the things that are also pushing us forward, right, we want to keep repeating it, that's when we can start to actually start to have some fun with it. And I learned this, you know, first when I was running this company, Rise. People were coming onto our platform to lose weight. And one of the things that often they would say is like, I want to go paleo, right? Or I want to completely cut carbs out of my diet. And what we would find is more often than not, even though they got short-term results, they very rarely would they get long-term sort of lasting results. You know, people would tend to yo-yo back because they love carbs, right? Like I love carbs. And they miss the bread, they miss the pasta. But when we could find a high quality habit, something that they actually enjoyed doing, that was the unlock, right? So like drinking a glass of water before every meal and having that be fun, like having those water bottles that have motivational sayings on them, putting a little bit of electrolytes in your water. That was a habit that people could very easily put on autopilot and enjoy it. So that was something that would actually stick. And even though their short-term results weren't as drastic, the long-term results really, really stuck. So what are these little high-quality habits? In the book, I talk about some ways that you can find those high-quality habits for yourself.
I love it. Okay. Everyone has to read this book. I feel like this message resonates so much with me because I talk a lot on the show about the old definition of success and this new definition of success and how it's so personal to people. And I think what you're talking about, Dharma, finding your essence, one, it's very relieving to know that it's already inside us. It's not another thing we have to go get. But two, I think a lot of us, to your point, have been so programmed to whatever it was internally, shut that down, quiet that voice or quiet whatever it is, to go and look for the external things, because that's what we share to the world. That's what the world constantly is telling us to put on Instagram, LinkedIn. I interviewed someone once and they were saying it's very Western to basically say, what's your name and what do you do? And so naturally, if it's the second question we almost ask everybody, it becomes a huge part of your identity. So anyway, I love your message. Absolutely, you guys, this book is so good. It's Everyday Dharma. I want to wrap up with just one quick tip. And it's going to be kind of a big question to ask you in one, like 1 minute answer, but how do you make failure work in your favor?
I think you make failure work in your favor by not getting up too quickly.
Putting that space in there.
Yeah. What I mean by that is oftentimes I think we sort of think of resilience as like, I got to get up as quickly as possible, right? Like I got knocked down, like let me dust myself up. But the problem with that sometimes is that we miss the growth. We miss the learning when we act too quickly.
Yeah.
And so I think it's hard sometimes to sit with your own discomfort. It's hard sometimes to sit with your own pain. But if you can learn how to do that just a little bit more, what that can unlock for you is the learning. It's the growth, right? And from a neuroscientific point of view, this is the difference between what we sometimes call resilience and what oftentimes neuroscientists refer to as post-traumatic growth, right? Mm. Because there's so much learning that can come from these moments. And by traumatic, we can talk about capital T and lowercase t. It can be little things. But my one piece of advice is don't feel the need to get up too quickly from these moments. You can sit on the ground for a little while and you can sort of sit with the discomfort. You can ask yourself some questions. You can love yourself in those moments. I think it's very, very important. And I think from that is where we grow. I think there's a beautiful quote by Rumi that the world will break your heart, break your heart, break your heart. And eventually your heart will crack open. And if you allow your heart to crack open, that's where you find what you've been looking for all along. That's where you find the strength. That's where you find the love.
Oh, I love that. That's a good place to leave this episode off. So Neil, where can people learn more about you, buy your books, you know, work with you, all that kind of good stuff?
Yeah. You can go to my website. It's sunilgupta.com, SunilGupta.com. And same handle on Instagram. I'd love to connect with you there.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Career Contessa podcast. Please take your time to rate, review, and subscribe. Remember, one review equals 1,000 new downloads, and we really, really appreciate it. Plus, I love hearing what you guys value about the show and your learnings. It's so great. You can learn more about Sunil and get a copy of his book, Everyday Dharma, via the show notes.